All right, good evening, everyone. This is Rochelle Wilhite, designated broker for Best Choice Realty. We are going to be going over seller representation tonight. We're going to be discussing the Form 47 in great detail. We're also going to be discussing, once you receive an offer, what are some things that you should be looking for or counseling your seller to do or to counter on an offer. We're going to start with something pretty easy to go through, and then obviously if we need to expand on another call when it comes to multiple offers. But we're going to look at some basics tonight. So we'll end about 6 o'clock, maybe a little bit after, about 6:02. If you have any other questions specifically about transactions or how to fill out a counteroffer, you certainly can email me or call me if you have a specific situation that you're working on right now. But go ahead and pull up the Northwest MLS. And let's go ahead and look at Form 47. This is a fairly new form. In fact, it was revised and it was instituted. If you look at the left upper-hand corner of the Form 47, it was instituted and revised. It was actually made on May 2014. So it's been around for almost 3 years now. And this was happening as we started to see multiple offers in King County, as we started to see the surges taking place. What we started to see was that sellers were looking to possibly put their home as a for sale by owner to take away and not put their house on the open market. And so what we were having happen was there's these off-market deals that were happening where our buyers were going out into the field and we're finding these properties that are not listed on the MLS and negotiating directly with the seller for that property. Now, fortunately for you, to protect your commission, most of the transactions, we've tracked them since we instituted this form at the Northwest MLS. Fortunately for you, there are not a lot of these off-market transactions that take place. I think the stat right now is about 3 to 4% are using this Form 47 and actually documenting the sale in this type of way where they have some sort of seller representation. If you use a Form 47, you do have to document the sale with the multiple listing service, including the terms and the price, and all of the financial institutions, appraisers, and other people related to the sale have access to this information. So, but it is a way that it's a tool in your tool belt. So we're going to go over how to use this Form 47. So I've got two situations right now where I have, one of them where I definitely have a seller representation agreement on file, and one where we were going to do a seller representation and then they changed their mind and decided to go ahead and list the property on the open market. So the first one I'm going to explain is the one that I currently have pending right now, and I'll give you an example so that it can kind of add some clarity to how to use this form. So I met with a good friend of mine. I went to school with their son. He's the superintendent of the school district. He's very well known in the community. In fact, if they move out of their property and they have 2 acres, if they move, it'll be really upsetting to all of their neighbors, and they really did not want to have to put a for sale sign in their yard. It was one of those things where they took great pride in their house. They owned their home free and clear. They bought it as an investment property because they were going to develop the land. It's about 2 acres with a home on it. And they're at the point now where they're at retirement age. They want to retire from their business and sell their property, and they wanted to move to Eastern Washington. So I met with them to discuss their options. They called me and said, "Rochelle, hey, we know you're in the real estate business. We know you have a lot of experience at working these types of things. We want to go over our options." And so I went in with a very open mind because I knew that, you know, these are very savvy business individuals. And they also, I know that they were shopping me as far as what I was going to charge them to list their property. And I knew going into this that they may not want to go that route because of their, you know, where their status was and how their neighborhood set up and all of the ins and outs, the things that are very important when making this type of decision and this type of property. So I did a CMA. I did 2 CMAs, 1 CMA for them with, you know, if we put it on the open market today, and this was last year about this time, what they could get for the house The property was not platted, meaning they had not gone through the process of making water, making sure water was in the street, that they were platted into different lots. All of their feasibility things they'd worked on a few years ago had, you know, expired. So they were basically back to square one, which is just a house on some acreage. Now, the acreage was worth something, and I talked with some people and found out what each of the what the acreage was worth without the home on it. And then I was able to put together two CMAs for them. And after we discussed the CMAs, the husband looked at the wife and he says, you know what, I just don't want to put my house on the market. I don't want to people to know I'm selling. I don't want to, he says, and he makes the comment, even though I might be getting less for my property. He made that comment to me and I thought, okay, I have a form for that. And I think I have a buyer for your property too. And he says, okay, Rochelle, I'm willing to pay you to bring a buyer. And but we obviously, we trust you and we would love to work with you and have you represent us. So I came back to them about a week later with a Form 47 in hand, and I filled it in with the seller's name with Best Choice Realty to represent the seller in the sale of a property. I put in the city, the county, basically attached the legal description as well. I pulled the preliminary title from title. And then I identified there was two developers slash buyers that I wanted to bring this property to their attention by. And so in essence, I was willing to represent the seller to an identified party, and I listed those two parties on the buyer section. And the firm agrees to represent the seller in the sale of the property as long as I can get the buyer and seller to agree on a price. And instead of 30 days in section one, I went ahead and put in 60 days. Gave me 2 months to connect with these two parties and these two entities to see if they would want the property. Now, again, no sign has gone up. I am representing the seller, and I'm trying to reach out to some of my connections to see if the two people that I had in mind are willing to buy this house that has 2 acres that could be platted and so that they could develop homes on this particular property. So I went ahead and put my name in number two, and on the compensation, I told them that I would, you know, again, you could put in 6% if you like. It's a blank to the percentage. Sellers shall pay the firm a compensation of blank or the total commission for representing the seller in the sale of the property. No compensation from the seller is otherwise due. So you go ahead and fill in how much, if you, let's say you didn't have a listing agreement, how much was the commission that you would be paid here to represent the seller? So in this case, I offered to do, if I put it on the open market, I was going to do it for 3% for them. But since I had a buyer, I told them I would do it for 2%. So I went ahead and filled in the total commission of 2%, but how much they also wanted to pay the buyer's agent. So I put in the total amount of compensation there so that they were clear on how much the total was going to be. And they agreed to pay a 2.5% to the person that brings the buyer. So on compensation, just like the listing agreement, I wrote in 4.5%. So I would get 2, and then the buyer's agent would get 2.5 to represent the buyer in that type of situation. If I represented the buyer, I got a total of 4.5% to represent both parties, and they would have been fine with that. To keep it simple, so there was no dual agency, I went ahead and had another agent write up the buyer side transaction, so that they had representation and then I had representation. But in order to start the negotiation, I had to have a Form 47 on file. So I filled in those sections. The part that I want you to draw your attention to is Section 5 of the Form 47, no marketing and fair market value. Seller acknowledges that the firm will not market the property through the MLS or otherwise, even though exposure of the property to the open market would increase the likelihood that seller would receive fair market value for the property. So the seller understood that, and when, you know, the husband looked at the wife and said, I don't care, even if we have to take less, I don't want to put a sign up in my front yard and let all my neighbors and all of the people I work with know that I'm selling. When he made that comment, then it reflected on this form, and he would be okay with signing this. They have to be okay with no marketing being done. I mean, it's just going to be sold to somebody that is identified, which I'd indicated in section, in the line number 8, the buyer section. So then he signs it, she signs it, and then I signed it. And in essence, this Form 47 is how I represented this seller in this development opportunity that will be closing next month. We're past feasibility. Everything's been done. The buyer is getting a great deal. The seller is also getting a great deal. But they may be taking, may be paying, you know, selling at not quite fair market value because it wasn't open to all of the cooperating brokers in the area. But that's their choice. They signed the representation agreement. So that's an example of one that I'm currently working with right now using the Form 47. But I have had instances where, you know, I go ahead and put a Form 47 together. I represent the buyer, the seller, identify a buyer that might work for that particular person. And for whatever reason, the buyer that, you know, couldn't get financing, couldn't produce a purchase and sale agreement. They went out to the property and they didn't like it. There's many reasons why it didn't come together on a Form 47, where that buyer that I listed in that section didn't procure a sale. But what this does is it leads me into the discussion with the seller saying, hey, I produced a buyer for you. I have many other buyers. And what I'd like to do is actually properly list your home on the open market. Let's get fair market value, do a ton of marketing like we do at Best Choice Realty, and actually list your property. And so it leads a lot of times into the discussion that, hey, Rochelle, you've done a really great job. Even though it didn't come together, I want to give you the opportunity of listing my home. And let's get a fair market value that will really drive people to my property. And there's strategies, obviously, for generating multiple offers and exposing the property to as many buyers as you possibly can. And so I pitch our full listing marketing package at that point in time and then get them to sign a 1A, which is full listing agreement, allowing for full market value and all of the things that we do to market the property to the open market. So that's how I did it on the other one, which didn't come together. I did a Form 47, but then the buyer was not able to kind of procure it. There were some issues on credit, and the sellers were like, we don't want to wait around even though we'd love to sell to our, you know, to the person that's renting our house. First of all, I know that, you know, you were going to represent us on that, and we really appreciate all your efforts, but, you know, since the tenants cannot buy, let's go ahead and get this thing on the open market. And then at that point in time, I introduced the 1A, which is the exclusive. So, again, that's another example of one that did not work out and one that has, and how you fill it out. And this is something you should make sure you point that out to them. They read that number five, which is, you know, they understand that selling to a buyer without exposure to the open market could cause you to receive a lower purchase price or less favorable terms. But sometimes they'll choose to go that route because they obviously maybe want to send a message to their community. They want to sell to somebody that they know or that you know, or they want to, you know, not have that. Even if they don't want to have be known out there, there's a way to be unknown on the MLS. So we could have gone that way, but they just didn't want to. They just wanted to go with a builder developer and take it off the market and not have a sign and go about it that way. So that was a perfect example of how we used it. Okay, we're going to shift gears and just talk about the offer in general. So let's just say I'm representing this seller, and we get an offer, and we want to make a counteroffer. And so there's a lot of people I see getting offers on their listings, and there are some terms that I think you need to be a little more cautious about when you're looking at these offers and how they're structured. So let's talk about some of those terms. I've got a Form 21 in front of me tonight, and I'm going to go through a few things. Like if I got an offer on a property, let me use this property in North Bend as an example. The property is listed at 1.15. The offer came at 1.070. And so we're going to want a counter price. Obviously, that's the price we want to counter. So the most common counter offer that's done is on price. That's the number one thing we see agents countering on is price if it doesn't come in at the full listed price. Or, you know, they're countering on price because they got multiple offers and they're countering on the price. There is obviously crossing something out whenever you line something out on the purchase and sale agreement. You can write the new price next to it, but anytime you do that, you must initial or have both parties initial, and that would be an effective counteroffer and its acceptance when both parties have initialed next to that. I prefer to use, if I'm representing the seller, I prefer to use, instead of having all these cross-offs and initials all over the place, I would much rather prefer to use a Form 36. And what that is a counteroffer addendum to the purchase and sale agreement. And the proper way to execute a Form 36 when you are the listing agent would be to, right above where the sellers sign on page 1 of the purchase and sale agreement, you can write this statement, and then you don't need to have all these initials and cross-offs throughout the contract. You can just go ahead and write out the terms that will be changed on the Form 36, and then both parties have to sign and acknowledge this counteroffer on that form. So it keeps the offer and counteroffer process a lot cleaner, and knowing when one has countered and when one has accepted the offer and counteroffer process. So when you get the counteroffer and you're thinking, my seller's not going to go for this, you know, let's bullet point some of the things we're going to change. I'll usually use like a little notepad, and I'll kind of go through it and detail out what are some of the areas of the contract that I know there's going to be some very important points for them. Because the seller's going to ask you, you know, Rochelle, what do you think? Where do you think, you know, would make this offer a strong offer? You know, we're really concerned about how much earnest money, and we want to make sure that these guys are solid on their financing. And obviously, we're not happy with that price. So those are the concerns they have. But you know what? They don't understand the Washington state law like you do, or that you should know. And so you're going to want to counsel them on a few other little things to tidy up or make that offer stronger. So from a seller's perspective, you're going to want to look at, obviously, the price, get a Form 36, and obviously the price is on there, the purchase price shall be, and then you should write the price in. And then on the first page of the purchase and sale agreement, right above the names, you would write pursuant to Form 36. So kind of in that section where all the addenda are listed, you could just write, type it in, pursuant to Form 36, so that it flags the other agent that, hey, we have a counteroffer, that we don't have all these cross-offs, that we're going to be looking at a Form 36, and that the Form 36, in order for it to be fully executed, the entire deal to be accepted, the seller and the buyer would both have to sign off on the Form 36 because we made the first page of the Form 21 pursuant to the Form 36. You would type that right above the seller's signature line in that addenda section, and that would be sufficient. There's no more cross-outs, things like that throughout the purchase and sale agreement. You can have the seller initial all the bottoms of the pages, sign the first page, and then write pursuant to Form 36, and then you're really just dealing with one piece of paper rather than going through and having to cross stuff out, line things out, which becomes very confusing at times for buyers and sellers who are trying to communicate on paper. So I'd much rather see a Form 36. When you have the Form 36, some of the things you're going to want to also consider, obviously the price on this one, but you want to check the other box. So let's say we wanted to change earnest money. In this one, they offered only $20,000, and my sellers feel much more comfortable with $30,000. That would cover them, you know, in case the deal falls apart, so we could get it back on the market. You want to think like that. You know, if I have to take, you know, if they don't close, if they don't fulfill their purchase and sale agreement on the closing date, what kind of money, what earnest money, if it was released to you, would be enough to kind of get you tied over until we get this thing sold to another buyer? That might be 1 month mortgage, 2 months a mortgage. It could just be their moving fee of like how much it's going to cost them to move. You want to ask them enough questions to understand where they're, the how important their earnest money is, what would draw. Obviously, the higher the better, but you also want to think reasonably about that buyer and how much money they have and how much they want to put at stake. But jumping it from $20,000 to $30,000 when you're putting 20% down, that's not a big jump, and I think the buyers would be willing to do that. So you would go ahead and counteroffer on that same Form 36. You would check the other box, and you would write, the proper way to write it would be Form 21, Term 7, earnest money to be $30,000. I see a lot of people that just write earnest money to be $30,000. I think that's understood. But in practice, you want to get very good at referring to at what point in the purchase and sale agreement are you modifying and indicating that by term number. So you also could write form charges and assessments levied before but due after closing. Say this property was had a sewer capacity charge and the seller didn't want to pay for that. They wanted to have the buyer assume the sewer capacity charge. So you may want to change Form 21, Term 13, charges and assessments levied before but due after closing, including sewer capacity charge, to be assumed by buyer. I may want to make that change or that counteroffer, and I could do that very simply by checking the other box and writing that term number onto the counteroffer addendum and rewriting that section. Okay, the other piece that is also very critical that I think gets negotiated a lot would be the closing date. So instead of saying or sooner, it's better to have an actual physical date. It becomes very confusing. Are we closing? What day? It's better to have a firm date that we can work toward. It's not advised to write or sooner or and or before, even though I do it all the time. It's actually better contractually to actually have a physical closing date that you're working toward. If it's, you know, if it says or sooner, what that means is that both parties would have to agree to a closing date of sooner, but it will be July 12, 2017, if that's what was written in the closing date section. Now, let's say that my seller is like, dang, we need more time. That doesn't give us a lot of time to go find a house. We have to scale down. We're, you know, we have to find a house to move our stuff to. So let's go ahead and see if the buyers would agree to maybe a July 20th closing date. Just give us an extra 10 days or so to get things rolling. So again, go back to our Form 36, make another bullet point under the other section, and just write Form 21 term 11, closing date to be July 20th, 2017, period. Okay, that would be what we would write on as well. Again, closing date to be on or before July 20th would be, make sure you put July 20th, 2017, would be sufficient and would be understood by the parties. But again, the proper way is to refer to whatever you're changing on the purchase and sale agreement. The other thing that gets changed a lot would be possession date. And, you know, that might be something you negotiate with the other party and you come up with a better possession date. Maybe your seller wants the weekend, you know, to move out. And that's common to see the counteroffer on possession date to be 2 days after closing to give the keys. Possession to be, again, you'd refer to the form, Form 21, Term 11, possession date to be 2 days after closing. So in that regard, you would be giving keys 2 days after you got the money, after it closed. That would give the seller some time to move out over the weekend. Okay. Anytime you have a possession date other than closing, you really need to have some sort of rental agreement. Make sure there's insurance that covers the seller throughout that term, those 2 days. What if there was a fire? What if there was some damage that was done to the property? It technically is the new buyer's responsibility, but the seller also has some sort of risk associated with that possession being later than the closing date. So if that's something important to your seller, you would need to write that in on a Form 36. If the possession date was not on closing, if it was like a day or two later, that can be negotiated, and that sometimes gives the seller a little bit of breathing room when they're trying to move out of their current residence and move to another residence. It's very rare that simultaneous close, meaning they close on the sale of their home and they purchase another home on the same day and give keys and accept keys on the same day. I'm trying to count on my hands how many transactions I've seen that have gone really smooth that way. Most of the time, there has to be a little bit of flexibility within the parties because of possession and closing. The other piece that I see a lot of mistakes being made on is when you represent the seller, and you, it's your job as a listing agent to make sure that FRPTA is discussed with the seller. And I see a lot of listing agents, they're doing a good job. They're actually attaching the form 35, what is it? It's 22E. It's basically the FRPTA form. I've got to remember the number. I would rather see you just, instead of doing the form, let escrow do the form and just have the seller declare on term 14, seller citizenship, FRPTA, seller is or is not a foreign person for purposes of U.S. income taxation. You could write that on the Form 36 if it's not checked. It is your responsibility to disclose that or have the seller disclose that FRPTA citizenship thing. The buyer's agent really shouldn't fill that part in unless they know. you've provided them with the disclosure of whether they are a foreign citizen or not. But it is your job to go in and fill that in or check that box after closing. Okay. The other things to as I'm looking at the offer here and things that we may want to change that I think a lot of you don't do a good job of countering would be on financing. A lot of you just let these guys go. And you've got to be a lot more concerned about your seller because that buyer's the buyer's agent that's representing a 22A financing contingency has all kinds of outs to get out of the contract. And then what happens to your poor seller is the seller has no recourse, meaning that there really isn't any way for them to get hold of that earnest money if there is a 22A finance contingency at play. So meaning the buyer could back out if the loan, they're unable to get financing, if the appraisal doesn't come in at the value. There's several different ways out of the contract on the financing contingency. So when you're dealing with a 22A, and let's say I had one and I only had one offer and it had a finance contingency, and I'm like, you know what, I'm good with that. At least we have an offer. This house has been on the market for a month. We want to make sure that we get a good buyer for this property. But I'm going to want to cut down some timelines and keep the buyer's agent and the buyer's lender honest. Meaning I want them to keep going with the deal. I don't want them to wait till like a week before closing and then find out that these guys can't get their loan approved. So what I'll do is I'll definitely look at term two and term three on the 22A. So when I counter, when I'm representing my seller in the best fashion possible, I will go ahead and counter back on form 22A, term 2A to be 5 days. I think that's reasonable to say that, hey, we're going to request loan information after 5 days after mutual acceptance. That gives the buyer plenty of time to meet with their lender, take the application, and then for us to get a notice with where the loan is, what status. We can request the loan information by sending over to the buyer's agent a 22AL. I got to tell you, I've been this whole form, 22A, was revised in February of 2017. And it was revised in 2016 and 2015, but I do not see very many 22ALs being sent over by the listing agent to the buyer's agent requesting loan information. There's a lot of things that happen during the loan process, and I think the listing agents have just been kind of lackadaisical. I'm going to flat out say that mostly lazy at representing their seller and not requesting that loan information by sending over the 22AL. Asking for updates on the buyer's loan application. The loan notice then would have to be on that 22AP. The buyer's agent would then fill out the 22AP, provide the name of the lender, the information that the buyer has provided, and a warranty that the buyer has provided all the information. And if they don't have, if they have not done that, then the buyer failure to give timely notice to the seller can terminate and put the home back on the market or sell it to somebody else. And there might be a backup offer that might be even better than what you've got here. And that's a good way for you to back out and go with something that's a lot more solid for your seller. But what I often see is no counteroffering was done when you represented the seller. The dates were 10 days, 3 days, and all of a sudden you've lost your momentum. You've lost the excitement because it's taken approximately 2 weeks to do this process when it shouldn't take 2 weeks to get updates about the loan process. If these guys are seriously putting 20% down, and they've wanted us to accept a finance contingency, there's no harm in asking them to cut down those timelines on section 2A, 2B, and 3A. I would see a strong counteroffer where it's more in the favor of the seller. If you are going to accept a 22A contingency, cut those timelines in half. I've seen contingencies 3A be 15 days. You got to think about how long does it take for the appraiser to get out to the property. Because 3A means the right to terminate, that after 21 days, I could send them over a notice as a listing agent asking them to waive their financing contingency, and then they would have to waive it or say, no, we are unable to waive it. At that point, your seller can make a determination on whether they want to go back on the open market or stay with the deal and keep the financing contingency intact. So it really keeps the buyer's lender honest, meaning they're going to work at a very fast pace to get things ordered and set up. And it also keeps the buyer focused that, hey, we may have another, we may put somebody in backup position, and I don't want you just wasting your time on the financing contingency at our cost. So those are some things I would definitely counter on this particular offer because all of the timelines were left blank, and we can button that up on the Form 36 by just stipulating the way I would write it would be Form 28, Term 2A, seller's request for loan information to be 5 days after mutual acceptance. Next bullet point, Form 22A, Term 2B, buyer's loan information notice to be within 1 day of receiving seller's request for loan information. And then another bullet point, seller's right to terminate. Term 22A, Term 3A, right to terminate notice at any time 21 days after mutual acceptance to be any time 21 days after mutual acceptance. That's what I would write on the Form 36. And then make sure as a listing agent, you are sending over the 22AR and the 22AL so you can keep the transaction moving along smoothly, that you don't foresee any problems. Because what happens if you don't, I get a phone call, it's usually like 4 or 5 days before closing. Oh, Rochelle, I'm representing the seller. Is there anything you can do? And I'm thinking, well, where were you the week after you went under mutual contract? Where were you 2 weeks after? Why was no notice sent over? Why was there no contact made with that lender? At what point did the lender give the notice of loan denial? There's something that doesn't sit well with me to know that the seller may have been not represented well because you as a listing agent didn't know you need to execute some of your rights. And that's done on the 22A very, very simply. Now, and I don't see enough of those happening with the listings that we have. So if you do have to counteroffer, if they have not waived financing contingency, most of the deals in King County I see are with our listings where they've waived financing, they've waived Form 17, they've waived inspection. Hey, you're in good shape with those types of deals. But there still is times, and it's not always going to be this hot in this marketplace, where you are going to have to deal with a 22A and you're going to have to do a good counteroffer to really get the offer buttoned up the way you need it to be so that your seller is protected as much as you possibly can and the deal can move forward. Again, it's a give and take kind of situation, and that's how we'll get to eventually when the market settles down. So hopefully that was helpful for you tonight, that you've got some good tips on how to execute your rights on the Form 22A and the AR, that you learned about the Form 47, and that you know how to properly write a Form 36 counteroffer. I always like to fill in on the Form 36. I'll conclude with this. The counteroffer shall expire, if not filled in, it's 2 days after delivered. Make sure you fill that in. Don't give them, I think buyer's agents are only giving us a day to respond. So when you send over a counteroffer, only give them a day to respond. I think that's appropriate. And then both parties would have to sign, and so it's official once the bottom part is the counteroffer is accepted. That is, in essence, mutual acceptance would be that date. So it's a lot better form to use than to cross off and try to hunt and peck when was mutual acceptance given. When using a Form 36, it's very clearly stated mutual acceptance would be on, the one I'm looking at here would be on May 20th, and where we were countering back May 19th, May 17th. We went back a few times on this Form 36, but once a counteroffer was accepted, we have a clear date to move forward and calculate everything off of. All right, so that's all I've got for tonight. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you next Monday.